Nicholas Parisi, this hour, author of Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Nicholas's website, rodserling.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got a Facebook page, too. You'll get that link when you go to coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. We'll talk more about Rod Serling and take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Nick Parisi with us. Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Nick, if Rod Serling were alive today watching television, what would he say about the current state of TV?
Well, I think in one regard, I think he would be thrilled with how adult television has become in the realm of drama. During the time that Rod Serling was writing, obviously we talked about some of the censorship, but not only the issues, but also the language and just the subject matter in general, even if it wasn't a social issue. Today there's so many shows that are so adult in scope. I don't even have to name them, but Mad Men and Breaking Bad, and not just cable, but network television. I think he would be thrilled with how the quality of those shows. Now, of course, we have many more channels now, and there's certainly a whole lot of junk too, but I think in general he would be happy with it. And one thing I could tell you for sure, he would hate reality television. He and I don't say that just that's not just me saying that. At the time, I guess reality television for its time, Rod had some very negative things to say about a show called This Is Your Life. If you remember This Is Your Life, This Is Your Life was a show where they bring somebody onto the show, normal, regular, everyday person, and they would, trot his family members out there, and they would go through his, scrapbook and look at, it was kind of reality television for the time, and he just despised the show. He thought it was just an invasion of privacy and everything else, so it's a reality television he would hate, but I think there are so many shows now that he would absolutely love.
Well, in old-time television, too, Nick, really did not understand racial mix-ups, demographics. When you look at some of these old shows way gone back, even the comedians, the game shows, they were all older white guys, and I'm not talking like middle age. I'm talking older white guys. In television, it would be difficult to get that kind of a person, like Jimmy Durante, for example. You think of him, he was a big superstar, very talented. I don't think he would make it today.
You might be right. Yeah, you could be right. I mean, well, listen, the field has grown so tremendously. There's so much more competition that there would be. But it's kind of like talking about Major League Baseball before Jackie Robinson.
Yep.
They didn't have the competition from the black player, from the Latin player, from all these places, and there were certainly people who played in the major leagues in 1941 who may not have made it in 1951 because there was so much more competition.
What would Rod say about all the different channels available now? In his day, there was just the three major networks. Now, my God, you've got hundreds of channels.
Yeah, well, he would love the freedom that it gives to writers and creators. That, in his day, if those three networks didn't want to air it, that was it. I mean, and in some cases, if he was, had under contract to CBS, if CBS didn't want to air it, that was it. Nowadays, you can go to so many different outlets to get your creation seen and heard. So, he would be thrilled with that aspect of it for sure.
I mean, Netflix and Amazon truly rival the networks now, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the best television being made right now is on those platforms.
That's amazing. Let's take some calls. Let's go west of the Rockies. Kurt in Boise, Idaho, to get us started. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, George. I'm glad you got Nick on. I can't wait to read the book. You mentioned earlier when you were talking to Nick about the impact of the fact that the entire series is in black and white. And, of course, Nick mentioned that, the film noir look. But I've always been amazed at what Rod was able to do with regarding the size of the sets, which to me was, as far as the visual impact was, which was a testament to the, the cinematographer and the lighting directors, which I just thought, mm-hmm. I was just blown away with what they were able to accomplish. So I was wondering from Nick if he knew how many cameras they used during the actual shoots.
Okay. Nick, do you know?
I do not know the answer to that question, but I will absolutely agree with Kurt that that's one of the striking things about the series is that, of course, the production level in terms of budget, it was a fairly generously budgeted show for the time, but of course, in terms of special effects, they weren't going to be able to give you the brilliant, spaceships shooting across the sky and that kind of thing. So they, so Rod had to work with a, you know, more relatively modest set, and so, and he did. He got the most out of those particular sets, and every now and then, to actually, because budget was always a concern, he would write a particular show that only took place in one room because it was going to be cheaper to make. You know,
yeah.
Two actors, one room, and that's it. And he would do one of those after they had a couple of expensive shows like Eye of the Beholder or, you know, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet or something. And then he would do one of these shows that kind of got the budget back under control.
He jump-started many careers, too, did he not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly there were a lot of, you know, stars and soon-to-be stars.
Robert Redford?
Yeah, yeah. Robert Redford actually got his first job, not on The Twilight Zone, but in another show that Rod Serling had written called In the Presence of Mine Enemies on Playhouse 90. It was the very first appearance by Robert Redford on television. And that was a great, great show, and he was very good in it, too.
Yeah, in the Twilight Zone episode, he was a cop. And the lady thought he was death coming to get her. I'm not going to say what the ending is, but that was a great show.
Yeah, it was. That was written by George Clayton Johnson, actually, and that's a terrific show.
What was the name of the show, Nicholas, where Agnes Moorehead was a woman in her house and a small flying saucer landed inside her house or something like that, and she beat it with a broom?
It's called The Invaders, and that was written by Richard Matheson, the late, great Richard Matheson. He wrote several episodes of the show, and that's one of the most well-remembered episodes of the series. It's largely dialogue-free. There's almost no dialogue in it until the very end when the space person, you know, says a few things.
We found out who they were.
Yeah.
And the other one I liked, too, was the lady who was having plastic surgery. Because everybody thought she was ugly, and she wanted to look like everyone else, and we sure found out what everyone else looked like.
That's the Eye of the Beholder, and that is, you know, if there's a quintessential Twilight Zone episode, I think that's it. That's the one, and again, one of the most well-remembered episodes.
And the one that really gave me the message of people was The Shelter, about that fallout shelter.
Yeah, The Shelter is a great episode. Serling wrote that one. And, it's about the idea that there's going to, you know, there's a bomb threat, a nuclear threat, and what does this community do when there's only one bomb shelter and they all want to get into it and they can't all get into it and they turn on each other. And it was a terrifically well-done episode.
Renee in San Francisco is with us. Hi, Renee. Go ahead.
Hi. There's an episode that's a very rare episode, but it was finally released years later. That was called Miniature.
Miniature. I don't remember that. Nicholas, do you?
Robert Duvall.
Absolutely. Another great, you know, great actor who, one of his early performances, Robert Duvall. That was one of the hour-long episodes. The fourth season of The Twilight Zone, they were all an hour-long as opposed to the half-hour episode.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and Miniature was one of the hour-long episodes, and it was involved in a lawsuit at the time that the series went into syndication. So it was not initially syndicated, so it was not seen for decades, about at least 20 years, until that was long settled. And there was a special on called The Twilight Zone Silver Anniversary Special, and they showed that particular episode along with a couple of others that had been similarly left out of the syndication package.
What was the tragedy when they were doing the Twilight Zone movie? A helicopter crashed or something like that?
Oh, yeah, it's a horrible, horrible incident. A helicopter crashed after an explosion, you know, a special effects explosion, and killed Vic Morrow, who was starring in that particular story, and two young children who were on the set. Cast a pall over the entire movie, of course.
Horrible, horrible situation. Yeah. Joe in Long Island, New York is with us. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Nick. A couple of questions. The first one would be, that seemed like it was very escapist within maybe someone's day back in the 60s. I'm just speculating, if you had a regular job and you came home and watched The Twilight Zone, that would be almost like an escape from your daily reality. And I guess people might have wanted that. And I'm wondering if there are any other shows really like that. My second question would be about the mysterious endings, which I think a lot of that could be almost, not necessarily epic, but could have unfolded into actual movies, additional scenes. where someone could take a Twilight Zone episode and kind of unfold it into an actual movie, you know, like a Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And to get to the first question, you know, the escapist aspect of the Twilight Zone, I mean, that, I think that is part of all science fiction and fantasy, of course, is that escapist tone to it. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because that is actually something that Rod Serling often pointed to about Night Gallery in the early 70s. During the end of the Vietnam era, he felt that Night Gallery was giving people an escape from the nightly news and seeing, you know, the stuff on the news about war and everything else, that they could go into the Night Gallery and escape through that. So he never really said that about the Twilight Zone, but I think a similar point can be made about the Twilight Zone as well. And it is surprising that someone hasn't taken, you know, a Twilight Zone episode and expanded it into a feature film, although there have been plenty of films that are certainly Twilight Zone influenced that could very well just as well be Twilight Zone movies that aren't called the Twilight Zone.
Wasn't Jack Klugman on one of the Twilight Zones?
He starred in 4 Twilight Zones.
Yeah,
actually.
He liked him.
He actually starred in one with Bill Mumy in Praise of Pip.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And he was terrific. Jack Klugman probably gave my favorite performances on the Twilight Zone in 3 of the episodes that he was in.
Was he a trumpet player in one of them?
Exactly, yeah. There's one called The Passage for Trumpet. Rod wrote that one. And I'll tell you a quick story about that episode. You know, Jack Klugman was so good in that episode, just so good, that the director actually wrote or called Rod and said, listen, I don't want to take the camera off of this guy. I just want to keep filming him. You know, is there any way we can make this into a 2-part episode? He wanted to expand the episode to an hour just because Jack Klugman was so good. And Rod said, you know, listen, we just can't. You don't have the budget. We can't do more than a half an hour. But that's saying something when the director says, listen, I'm just going to let this guy go and I'm just going to film whatever he does.
Classic, classic, classic. Jason in Portland, Oregon's with us now. Jason, go ahead, sir.
Well, were you folks aware that present day there's a Twilight Zone radio theater, and they take some of the old episodes and they transfer them to radio, and they also incorporate present day themes and have current topics, like just a couple weeks ago I heard one that had to do with nanobots eating up oil spills and the problem that could present. And I just thought, and it's sanctioned, I think, with the Serling estate.
Cool. Did you know about that, Nick?
I was not aware of the current current radio series. No, there actually was a Twilight Zone series of radio dramas of the original episodes that was produced not too long ago. But no, I wasn't aware of a current one. No.
Did Rod ever write for radio in his early days?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's where he really got his start, was in radio. His first sales were to a series called Grand Central Station that aired, I think, on CBS Network. And he wrote, you know, for radio in college. And so, yeah, that was the beginning before he broke into. And actually, the funny thing is, he actually went back to radio and created a radio series in 1954. So basically 4 years after he had broken into television, he actually went back to work in Cincinnati and created this radio series called It Happens to You. And it was a series of 13 original radio scripts.
Where did he end up living? Los Angeles?
Yes. He lived in Los Angeles and Pacific Palisades for most of his professional career, and then he always went back to Ithaca in upstate New York every summer, and then he was teaching at Ithaca, so he kind of gradually spent more time in Ithaca later in his life.
When he got sick, was it a prolonged illness, or did he go suddenly?
It was pretty sudden.
He was 50 years old, wasn't he, or something like that?
He was 50, yeah. He was 50, yeah. And he had a couple of heart attacks, and he went in for a bypass procedure, which was fairly, you know, cardiac bypass procedure, which was
fairly new
at the time. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, how new it was, because if you read some of the news stories at the time about the surgery, they'll explain to you exactly what the surgery is. You know, they're going to take a vein, you know, artery from this here and put it here. It's like nowadays you wouldn't have to say any of that. You know what a cardiac bypass is. But that back then, it was so new that they had to explain this surgery. And he had the surgery, and the doctors thought it was successful, and by the time they were sewing him up, he had another heart attack on the table.
Gosh.
And that was pretty much it.
Steve's with us, first-time caller in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Steve.
Hi, George. I got a little trivia about Rudd. I lived in central New York from 72 to 75, And I worked on a military base called Seneca Army Depot, which is now closed.
Okay.
And it was a big arsenal that had nuclear weapons, quite a few, actually. It's been on the news. Anyway, Rudd's home was about 2 or 3 miles from that base. And a little town called Romulus up the road, about a mile and a half or 2 miles, was a little post office where I used to have a post office box, and that's where Rod used to send out when he had a swimming pool built on his property there, a couple of miles away, right next to the base. It's actually an arsenal, and I used to talk to the postmaster. It's like a one room post office. And I said, I heard Rod Serling was around here. He said, yeah, he comes in once in a while. And I always wish I had met him, but I never did. But I think that's where he used to send his tapes out to Los Angeles to be contrived into his TV program. And,
as I said, he lived right on Lake Cayuga in Ithaca, and that's not far. It could very well be, and he would dictate in Ithaca and send the tapes out to Los Angeles to be transcribed.
Interesting, Steve. What else do you know about him?
What's that?
What else do you know about him? That's cool.
Well, when his career started to sink a little bit, he went back to that area, and he taught at I believe it's Cornell University down there, and he's buried not far from his where his home was in little cemetery called Interlaken, right on the lake. He must have loved that area. He and his wife, when they first got married, they had their honeymoon there on the lake. Her relatives, parents probably, owned that property, and he bought it eventually, and they lived there. And he always went back there on summers to write and relax. And but a funny thing is, he used to do little radio promotions for people he knew in the area, like a shoe store or whatever it might be, small store. I mean, that was kind of cute. You'd hear him locally.
Just to help them out. Now, let's just to help them out.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything I heard, he was really nice guy.
That's the way to do it. And Nick, it sounds like the guy, he had a heart of gold.
He did. He really was incredibly generous with his time. He would do things like that all the time. He would narrate things for free for people at the college or local businesses, as Steve mentioned. And yeah, he would absolutely do that. And going through his correspondence, Rod Serling kept everything he ever sent. Every letter he ever wrote, he kept, and they still exist. And you would think he responded to every single fan letter he ever received personally, personal letters, signed and everything. He took that time to do that. And
it's impressive.
Really amazing that you can't really find somebody saying a bad word about Rod Serling.
No, you really can't. Nick, we're going to take a quick break, then we're going to come back with final phone calls with you. Special guest, Nick Parisi. As his book, of course, is called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination. Next hour, we're going to talk about haunted antiques. Oh, yes. Get ready for that on Coast to Coast. And when we come back with Nicholas Parisi, we'll talk more about his book on Rod Serling and take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Nick Parisi with us. Nick, where do people get your book on Rod Serling?
It should be available just about anywhere that books are sold, as they say. It's available on Amazon now, Barnes & Noble. If they don't have it in the physical store, they'll certainly be able to order it for you. Or you can go directly to the University Press of Mississippi website. It's a long site, but if you Google that, I'm sure you'll come up with it there as well.
Tell us about the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation.
I'd love to. Yeah, it's I'm a member of the board of directors of the foundation. It's a Binghamton, New York-based charity that looks out for Rod Serling's legacy and promotes his legacy in Binghamton as well as around the world, really. And we're working on, you know, we've done a couple of, we call them Serling Fests the last couple of years, where we've essentially had a Rod Serling convention. People have come and spoke, and Ann Serling, his daughter, and Jody Serling, they've both been, you know, been there and, you know, spoke about their dad, and we've watched Rare films and, you know, had panel discussions and radio perform, you know, scripts, radio scripts performed. So we've had, you know, we've done a lot of things like that for the community. And it's just about keeping Rod in the public eye as much as possible. And we're trying to, at this point, we're trying to really to get a statue built for him in Binghamton, his hometown. He loved his hometown. That should come across through several Twilights and episodes. And so we're trying to get a statue built for him there. We're trying to get a Rod Serling Museum in Binghamton. So these are all things that we're working towards.
Gosh, I would have loved to have had him on this show, Nicholas.
I would love to have spent 5 minutes with him. I was 5 years old when he died. So
what a classic.
I had a chance.
Oh, would have been something else. What a great interview he would have been.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He always was.
To the phones we go. Let's go to Linda Marie in Medford, Oregon. Hello, Linda Marie.
My name is Talking Tina, and I'm going to kill you.
Ah, that was a classic.
One of my favorite episodes. Also, the the old man on the radio.
Are you talking about me?
No, the old man who had found the radio in the attic, and played it played music and shows that only he could hear.
Yep, classics.
Yeah. And also, George, I wanted to praise you for how you thought up this show tonight. I mean, after Nick is a guest talking about haunted artifacts, and they're tied in together. So many Twilight Zone episodes about.
Oh, absolutely. I've got to give credit to our executive producer, Lisa Lyon, and Tom Danheiser, our producers, for putting that together.
Yes. And also, Nick, I want to know, what was the first episode you saw?
You know, that's it's a funny question, because I think most people can tell you for certain what Twilight Zone episode was the first one they saw. I cannot tell you for certain what the first one I ever saw was. I could probably narrow it to a couple. The Hitchhiker is one that I think was definitely one of the first ones I ever saw. But for whatever
going my way, right?
One. Yeah, going my way, and he's chasing a driver. I'm not chasing her, but it's just showing up on the road constantly on her road trip. That's a creepy one. Rod wrote that one. And that was definitely one of the first ones. But for whatever reason, I cannot pinpoint if that's the first one I ever saw.
Do you remember the plane that couldn't land, and then you'd look down and you could see the Brontosaurus and the dinosaurs, and it kept going back into time, I guess?
Yeah, it's called The Odyssey of Flight 33. It's about a plane that breaks the sound barrier and somehow finds itself back in prehistoric times. And, Rod's brother, Robert Serling, also a very successful writer, actually. He wrote The President's Plane is Missing, which was a bestseller at the time, and it was made into a television movie. But he was an expert in aviation, and he actually Rod consulted with him about that particular episode and other episodes that he did. If it ever had anything to do with aviation, he went to his brother for advice on those. So he actually got a technical consulting credit on that particular episode.
Next up, we go to Bradford in Angels Camp, California. Hi, Bradford.
Hey, Nicholas. I'm pretty sure that this was a Rod Serling tale. It involved what they called a troglodyte that was in a capsule. It started with a guy at a bar looking kind of despondent or whatever probably trying... trying to give up drinking, and somebody came up and gave him a matchbook, said, call this number. And so he was curious. He called it. They said, well, come over to, I think it was going to a place where they gave him this capsule. And they said, but the one caveat is you cannot drink again. Must not drink, because
always a message.
It will make you very, very uncomfortable, give you a really bad stomach reaction. And so what it was it was some little organism, and it fed on alcohol. So it was dormant unless you drank alcohol, in which case it would wake up, and then it would just, crave the alcohol and make you really, really sick, because it was growing.
That sounds somewhat familiar. It's definitely not a Serling, I can tell you that for sure. But it does sound that part about it feeding on the alcohol and growing, that does sound somewhat familiar to me, but it's definitely not a Serling.
God, they were so many classic shows, though. They all had these different messages. Remember the one where the camera took pictures of the future?
Yeah.
And you'd aim it at a racetrack board, and you'd get the winning horse and all that?
Yeah. Most Unusual Camera, it was called. And that's one of the, your previous caller was talking about Haunted Artifact. I mean, that camera was an artifact of the Twilight Zone. You know, they had plenty of those. The telephone that Billy Mumy was talking about that he talked to his dead grandmother on. You know, there's always those props that were the, were the MacGuffin, so to speak, of that particular episode.
Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hey, Bear.
Hello there, George. Once again, always a pleasure. But Nick, I swear he is some kind of a character. I'm loving the Twilight Zone and so forth. But matter of fact, I've got one of my favorite stories to tell you. But just before I do that, how about that Rod Serling and smoking those nasty cigarettes?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Yeah. He really was addicted. He tried to quit several times. He never could quite do it.
Because I used to think, either he really loves cigarettes, or Dorothy Duke and R.J. Reynolds were paying him a lot of money to smoke those cigarettes.
No, you're probably right. Way too much. He'd come out on the set smoking, wouldn't he?
Oh, sure. It's hard to find a picture of Rod Serling where he doesn't have a cigarette in his hand. It's just it was attached to him. It was constant.
In those days, it was the thing to do. I remember Dean Martin lighting up on stage. Sammy Davis Jr. All those people would come out with cigarettes. I mean, it was the thing.
Sure.
Crazy. Let's go next to Manuel in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Manuel.
How you doing, George? Good morning.
Good morning to you, too. Thanks for calling us.
And, Nick, it's a great pleasure to talk to you because Rod Serling really inspired me when I was young. I started seeing him when I was 7 or 8 years old on Fridays. It would be Twilight Zone at 10:30, and then at 11 was Project Terror. And then on Saturdays was Night Gallery and Fright Night. And so that was very, very interesting.
That's a heck of a lineup, yeah.
Those were great days for television, weren't they, Nick?
Some of them were, yeah. You know, it's funny Manuel mentions the exact shows that were on, because I can tell you when I was watching Twilight Zone, when I was maybe 11 or 12, this is at school nights, and I was in fourth grade or something. I would watch, it was The Odd Couple at 11 o'clock, The Honeymooners at 11:30, Star Trek at midnight, and The Twilight Zone at 1 a.m. And I would do my best to stay up till 1:30 every night to watch those shows in order, and I very often would.
Pierre in Kansas City, Missouri is with us now. Hi there.
Hi, I'm impressed with your memories. They're fantastic, all the detail you have.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could help me with some trivia. When I was reading science fiction in the 70s, there was a short story that started out with the end, and then it had a little segment, and you were rooting for somebody. Then it had the middle, and then by the time you got to the beginning, you found everything was all turned around, and I've been thinking about that story for a couple of months, but I don't know the author.
Oh, God, no, I couldn't tell you that. That particular trope of starting with the ending and going back to the beginning, it has been done, a few times, in stories and in film. I don't know if you've ever seen a movie called Memento. That was the idea of that movie. The whole movie was told kind of backwards. It was started with the ending, and you went gradually backwards to the beginning. But no, that I couldn't tell it from that description who may have written it.
Didn't One Step Beyond pop up after Twilight Zone?
Yes. The Outer Limits came after the Twilight Zone as well. But no, actually, One Step Beyond, I believe, actually preceded the Twilight Zone by a year. Outer Limits came afterward, but I believe One Step Beyond started in 1958, I think.
Next up, we go to Ed in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Edward, take it away.
I appreciate it, George. Nick, Rod Serling, man, he was Oh, he had the ability to be able to understand human nature. Because if you listen to a lot of his episodes, and I've got every one of them, and I recycle them about every 2 months, you know, every one of his shows has a point to it that he's trying to point to, you know. And I think it's because of his experiences as a combat soldier during World War II, which, you know, was all about the Nazi movement and all of that, you know, and everything he'd been through. But one of my favorite episodes, it's hard to say which is my favorite, but I think it had to be the one that's the B-25 Mitchell twin-engine bomber coming home from Italy crashes in the desert. The captain of that airplane didn't go on that mission for whatever reason, which was Bob Cummings.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Cummings just happened to be walking by and seen this newspaper of his airplane they had found laying in the desert. And he went back in time, well, he went back to the desert in his mind and relived the experience, even though he didn't fly that mission, you know. And anyhow, he ended up in a hospital room and having psychiatric care, trying to find out, you know, what caused him to have the nervous breakdown. And it was because of the shock of seeing that airplane on that newspaper just recently, you know. And when the show ended, close to the ending of it, the nurse brought his clothing out there, and she said, well, there's sand in his shoes. And so somehow or another, he really transported himself back in time to where that B-25 had crashed. You know, several of those shows that Rod Sterling did, he had a time machine. You know, one of them, this guy, you know, went back in time 3 different times, and he thought he would try to alter events that took place. One of them was the sinking of the Titanic. The guy went back, tried to change that. Well, he failed. One time he went back and tried to stop the Japanese from being annihilated in Hiroshima, trying to warn them. That didn't do any good. He got thrown in jail for his efforts on that. So he went back, and he ended up in Nazi Germany. Thought he could alter that event.
Right.
He couldn't, of course. But, man, I don't know. It'd be hard to say which would be my favorite episode. The Christmas story, the guy that played Art Carney played the Santa Claus in a department store. And Caldwell was his name. He wanted to be the biggest gift giver of all times. The guy was a lush, right? And when he got a break from the department store, he went and got drunk, came back. He was sitting up on the chair. This little boy jumped up in his lap. Santa Claus was stoop drunk, man. I mean, he fell out of the chair onto the floor, you know, where she got fired and everything. He went outside, and he was all downed out. And he went in the back alley and picked up a bag, and it turned into gifts. Mysteriously, the bag just all of a sudden became full of gifts instead of, you know, empty cans. Man, he went around giving gifts to everybody, and it just – and that story, you know, and the guy that ran the department store, they found Caldwell giving these gifts out at this place like a John 3:16 mission type place, you know. Policeman comes in there and goes, where'd you get all these gifts? Have you got a receipt for all these gifts, blah, blah, blah? And he goes, no, I found the bag and the gifts are in it, and I'm just giving them out. Took him to the police station, and the department store owner came in there and said, yeah, there it is. There's the merchandise. Caldwell, you're a thief, blah, 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 you know. And the guy's name was Mr. Dundee, the department store owner, right? And they emptied the stuff out of the bag at the police station. There wasn't nothing but empty cans in it, right? And so they had to let him go. And, of course, the store owner sitting there scratching his head, the policeman scratching his head, couldn't figure out where all those gifts were coming from, but they were coming out of that bag. So just before they released Caldwell, Santa Claus, he reached into the bag and grabbed out a bottle of wine, 1933, and handed it to Mr. Dundee.
Huh.
You know, said, Merry Christmas. And both of them got pretty toasted on the wine, and they walked outside, and they seen Santa Claus flying overhead in a sleigh with reindeer,
oh,
and elves sitting beside him. And that right there just catches my heart every time.
Oh, I love it. And you, as you mentioned something about cans, Ed, remember Kick the Can, Nicholas?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, Kick the Can, and that was actually remade in the Twilight Zone feature film as well, about a old folks home where one of the people there wants to get the residents to play Kick the Can to feel young again, and of course they do become young again by playing Kick the Can, and the one person who was against it the whole time, he didn't play and he didn't get to become young, and he regrets it obviously, and that was written by George Clayton Johnson actually. That's a terrific episode.
We're running out of time here, Nick, but I've got to tell you, this is a topic that is so dear to my heart. It brings back memories when I was a kid watching television. My folks were there in the living room with us. Those were great times, weren't they?
It's great memories, yeah, yeah. It was a different time, and you know, for all of us. And yeah, it's great to TV can bring you back that way. You know, so it's it's great to think about.
Life was different too.
Sure, it sure was. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
As a kid, it didn't have a care in the world, did we?
Yeah, and that's what and you know, that's something that Rod Serling was yearning for in a lot of those Twilight Zone episodes, to be able to go back to being a kid and have being carefree and being innocent and less stress and everything else, and that came out in so many stories.
By the way, Billy was wrong about one thing: you're not a bad man.
I can take it from Bill Mooney. He can call me that. That's right.
That's a classic. And Nick, one more time, give out your website if you would for people.
Sure. Well, the Rod Serling Memorial Foundation can be found just at rodserling.com, www.rodserling.com. And I have a Facebook page that's dedicated to the book, so it's not my personal page. It's for the book. It's facebook.com, and then it's /Rod Serling Dimensions, all one word, Rod Serling Dimensions. The working title for the book was Dimensions of Imagination, so it was that, but the book is called Rod Serling, His Life, Work, and Imagination.
Super. Nick, thanks again. Up next, we're talking about haunted collectibles and collectibles too, next.